It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been 57 years since Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. delivered the historic I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. But Dr. King's dream lives on in Pittsburgh through the words of students celebrated yesterday at a ceremony at Carnegie Mellon University. Joining us are two of this year's college prize winners in poetry, junior drama major Joss Green. Welcome, Joss.
Hi.
And senior neuroscience major Isabel Yoon. Isabel?
Hi.
As well as CMU professor Jim Daniels. He's the founder and director of the MLK Day Writing Awards. Jim, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Jim, we're going to start with you. You've been presenting these awards since 1999. How many schools participated this year?
That's a good question. So we had 25 high schools, which is a new record in terms of the numbers, and we had about 8 to 10 colleges. I can't remember exactly.
Have they been increasing the numbers through the years?
Oh, definitely. And then when we started out, we were limiting it to Pittsburgh Public School students, and then we expanded to include Western Pennsylvania. And we didn't have a college contest at first. We just had some Carnegie Mellon students read. So we've been expanding that as well.
The writing prompt encourages young writers to think about their experiences with difference and discrimination. Why do you think it's so important to hear these perspectives, especially from young people?
Well, the young people have a lot to teach us all, as we know. And I think we ask specifically, in other words, sometimes people think of Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. We're going to write inspirational sermons or more general statements of solidarity and in the spirit of the civil rights movement. But we're looking for more personal stories. Mm-hmm. And stories that they might not have an opportunity to tell or to write about in their regular school classes, and we're trying to create a safe space for that.
Is there something special about the medium of poetry, of prose, that maybe helps express those experiences?
Well, it depends on the individual, but I guess my feeling as a writer myself is it's hard to hide for yourself in a poem or even in a short prose piece.
Mm-hmm. Isabel. You were honored for your poem, Quality Inn. What inspired that?
So I wrote this poem in September for a poetry class I had, and this event that I talk about actually happened 1 week right before school started, so it was fresh in my mind. And for me, poetry is a lot about kind of working through experiences I've had, so writing about that experience was really helpful for myself, too.
Joss, what about you? You submitted a piece with a lengthy title. It's called The Fancy Media Company Uses the Word Slave to Describe Machines Controlled by the Master Computer. What message were you trying to convey?
I was writing a lot about, this also actually happened to me, so I was writing about the experience of being a person who's been affected by the prison system and coming to a school with a ton of white kids who don't understand what that's like and trying to kind of work through being a person who's been traumatized by that system.
Mm-hmm. To both of you, what made you want to submit your pieces for the MLK Awards, Joss?
I submitted last year, and I submitted again because I feel really strongly that to keep this type of contest going, we have to continue to submit to it or else it'll kind of die out. So I just wanted to make sure that there was still a body of poems that could be gone through.
Well, Joss, you said you submitted last year. You won last year as well, did you not?
Yes, I did.
And Isabel, why did you feel like you wanted to take part in this competition, if you would?
So I heard about this competition in Jim's class last spring, but it was a little too late to submit then. But thankfully, I was in time for this year's competition. And I really wanted to just tell my story, especially the experience that I talk about. I feel like it was important for people to understand my perspective on it, too.
Mm-hmm. To both of you, what was important about sharing your story? I mean, the images, what you want to say is vivid in your minds, but why did you want to share that story? Joss?
For me, this story in particular, it had just been really weighing on me, and I felt like it was really important that the people around me heard and understood what it can be like to be kind of the only black person in a room when someone says something that's insensitive, and how hard that is and how much how if that happens a lot of times, it can really take a toll on you.
Mm-hmm. And Isabel?
For me, when this event first happened and I was telling my friends about the story, I did feel a little silly sometimes because I was thinking, you know, am I exaggerating what happened? But ultimately, I think that the emotions that I've had afterwards are really valid. And I think it's important for me to tell people that even the smallest of words can have a really big impact.
Mm-hmm. Our guests on The Confluence are Jim Daniels, founder of the Martin Luther King Jr. Writing Awards, and two of this year's winners, CMU students Isabel Yoon and Joss Green. Jim, back to you. How have you seen the awards evolve over the last 20 years? You've added some new categories, right?
Yeah, in fact, this year we have a drama category, and we're having a play as part of the awards presentation. Mm-hmm. So my attitude as the organizer of the contest is, if somebody comes up with something new, a new idea, let's run with it. And that's helped the awards evolve and grow over the years. And unfortunately, one of the sad things that we say every year is, well, in light of recent events, the awards are more important than ever. But every year there are some recent events. Mm-hmm. But I think all of us being in the same room together, talking about these issues that so often divide us, end up being an important moment that we can build on.
What about the nature of the submissions? Have the kinds of topics the students write about, even the way they express themselves, has that shifted over time?
It's hard to generalize, but I think it has. One topic that's been coming up more and more are gender and identity issues. Mm-hmm. When I think about 21 years ago, that wasn't coming up so much. And I think that's a good thing.
What is on the minds of your college classmates, whether it's talking about difference and disparity? Isabel?
For me, I would say, so around me are a lot of second generation Asian students. So mm-hmm. there is a lot of discussion on the kind of identity issues and cultural issues we have, especially since when racist events like this happen and people tell us to go back to our country, we feel like this is our country. But mm-hmm. I guess that's one of the biggest issues that we talk about.
Mm-hmm. Joss?
Yeah, I feel like Jim's correct that gender has been something that I've been talking a lot with my friends about, and specifically in the School of Drama, we're talking about a lot.
Joss and Isabel, both your pieces are kind of heavy. Joss, you write about a future and a privilege that other teens you saw don't have. Isabel, yours speaks to shame imposed by a man in an elevator. What is it about writing poetry that helped you share these ideas, Isabel?
For me, poetry is about being very specific in the details. And I think there's a lot of power in just talking about the details of a moment and allowing the people who are listening to also be a part of that. So I think poetry was a really great way for me to talk about this experience.
And Joss?
For me, poetry is about assessing my relative privilege and assessing the fact that I can be not privileged in some spaces and extremely privileged in others. Mm-hmm. And so this poem is a lot about how at school I'm not very privileged, but when I walk into a youth prison, I really am.
Mm-hmm. To any of you, is writing a form of activism?
I think it can be.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is.
And Jim?
Yeah, and that's part of the reasons I founded the contest, and maybe it connects to me as an individual, but I'm somebody who's more likely to write things down than to be leading a protest march or something mm-hmm. like that.
All right, Jim, you have two very bright student prize winners sitting right beside you now. What usually determines the winning pieces?
We're definitely looking for specific stories. Like if a student is walking into a store and they're getting followed around, we want to be in the store with them to feel that discomfort. So we're looking for specific detail and just tell your story, and we can imagine things from that moment you put us in, as opposed to talking about abstract issues, which sometimes we do when we talk about these things.
All right, two-time award winner Joss, what specifically were you looking for when you were judging high school entries?
I was definitely looking for personal accounts and moments that popped off the page that I really felt like I was feeling like I was there with the person when I was reading it.
Mm-hmm. Is technical ability come into play in the writing? For the judging, I should say?
That's a very good question, and it's something we measure, the meaning of the story and how it's told. How well does it have to be told? Because particularly when you're dealing with high school students, it's not going to be perfect. But if it's strong enough to move us, I think, then we can overlook some of the, you know, grammatical problems or things like that.
I understand all the prize-winning work was published in a chapbook. Isabel, Joss, what's it like to see your name in print like that? Isabel?
It's very cool. It's my first time seeing it in print like this, so.
Joss?
It's really exciting. It's invigorating to be with all these other pieces that I think are really important.
Do you plan to keep writing? I mean, we mentioned neuroscience, we mentioned drama. Do you plan to keep writing?
Definitely. I think I've mentioned this before, but writing is a way for me to work through my experiences, and it's really therapeutic in a sense, so I write on a daily basis.
And Joss?
Yeah, I've been writing since I was in second grade, so that's not going to stop anytime
soon. Nothing's stopping
you.
Jim, what are your hopes long-term for the program? And we're 20-plus years into this program. What are your hopes for the future of this?
Yeah, I couldn't imagine them lasting this long, and I'm happy that they've weathered some various difficulties over the years. But I have a couple specific goals in terms of moving forward. One is I want to increase the prize money to award these wonderful students. And the other is I want to involve previous winners, as we're thinking about calling them MLK Fellows. Because one of the things we do as part of the program is I go into a lot of schools and public schools and talk about the awards and do writing exercises with them and things like that. So some previous winners who could help out with that and help out with the judging, that would be pretty exciting.
I want you to think back 20 years, what you were thinking then and what you're experiencing now.
It's kind of a personal story, but I'll try and tell it quickly. So I come from Detroit, and right on the edge of Detroit, where it was a kind of a racist environment in various ways that were brought up, 1967 riots in Detroit. And then I had a course in graduate school from James Baldwin. And he really challenged me to look at my own past in a serious way, in a specific way. So when I started the awards, I was just trying to continue that journey, partly for myself, but also to just that learning process of hearing other people's stories has been very important to me, you know, and that's where I started.
All right. Joss, Isabel, could you close us out by reading a selection from your poems? Who's first? Isabel?
I can go first. My poem is called Quality Inn. The cheapest hotel in this landlocked town had such small elevators. Mom and I, 엄마 우리 운전사 너무 착했지. We're soft-spoken. 너무 재밌었어 오늘. Our whispers cramped. 방에서 맛있는 거 먹자. Among the rumble, 간식 뭐 있지? And dings of that elevator. Speak English. He looked down, pulled his hat lower. Mom and I could not look at each other. Shame is loud in silence. Maybe one day I will forget your hat, your voice, but I cannot forget my silence, my naked black eyes detached in the hotel mirror that night, the yellow stain and her mother, our bloody tongues cut silent in that suffocating elevator.
Isabel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joss?
This is an excerpt from my poem. The fancy media company uses the word slave to describe machines controlled by the master computer. I sit in this classroom full of white people, and they casually throw around the word slave like I haven't had that word etched into my brain like some sort of sick branding. I am everywhere but in my seat, anything but focused. I try to remember the faces of the boys that I would memorize 5 years ago, baptize them all wanted, give them the space to be whatever they desire, to roam wherever they want to roam, even if it's only in my brain. My white classmates have never known slavery. They have never looked it in the face and known that they are lucky to not be in the concrete facility, right along with the boys who look just like you. These white people will never understand just how inherent this type of survivor's guilt is. I've spent my whole life regretting my own freedom.
Thank you, Joss. Joss Green and Isabel Yoon are two of this year's prize winners in college poetry. Jim Daniels is a CMU professor and the founder of the MLK Day Writing Awards. Thanks to all of you for your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. State government buildings are using less energy, but they're still a long way away from a Wolf administration goal of a 26% reduction. And a conversation with the author of a book that takes a look at an issue often hidden in the LGBTQ community. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Pat Boone is not known for making aggressive music. In fact, he's even described his own sound as a little vanilla. It was a shock then on this day in 1997 when Boone released In a Metal Mood, No More Mr. Nice Guy, an album of lounge-inspired heavy metal covers. Boone, a staunch conservative, had long been outspoken about the no goodness of heavy metal music, even calling it degrading and depraved. But hey, people can change, right?
Crazy. Hey, but that's how it goes.
For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehart.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The path to presidential victory runs directly through Pennsylvania, and polls show it'll be a close race in 2020. So over the next year, we'll hear from four voters at the center of this election about the issues that will sway their choice at the ballot box. This month, our voters talked to 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins about where they get the information that will shape their votes.
The media voters consume has the power to inform how they view everything that happens until the election.
I was reading about this and just absolutely in shock.
Mary Henze is 53 and lives in Jefferson Hills. She was a Democrat for decades before supporting Trump in 2016. When I talked with her in December, she mentioned a story about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's son that I hadn't heard before. So she found a video clip that her friend shared on Facebook.
The less told story surrounding Paul Pelosi Jr. It's still unraveling on the sidelines following revelations.
I asked Mary who reported the story.
One American Network. And these are the things that nobody wants us to know.
I had never heard of One American Network and asked her to look it up on her phone.
One American Network, also referred to as One American News, is an Twitter account, had a history. Oh, whoa. Thank you.
Can you keep reading what it says?
Absolutely. Twitter account had a history of tweeting falsehoods and conspiracy theories.
The Pelosi story, for example, was nothing more than a debunked conspiracy theory involving Ukraine. There are news sources like OAN to reflect every political opinion, and voter misinformation is a broad problem. Mary, for example, mostly watches Fox, and while she likes that they occasionally bring on Democrats, research suggests the more you watch Fox, the likelier you are to be exposed to misinformation. Like Mary, Republican Ed Swiklinski trusts his ability to see through media bias. He's 46, works in cybersecurity, and lives in Bethel Park. He voted for Trump, but has voted for some local Democrats. Ed watches Fox, too, and also listens to Rush Limbaugh.
I listen to Rush Limbaugh because he agrees with me. He has the same point of view I have, that we both love this country, that is the best thing that ever is. I do see the other side. I just don't listen to it as much.
Which he says isn't a problem. Everyone's news feeds will look different because everyone is different.
I think they're going to find the news that's going to reflect what they believe.
To some extent, Savannah Henry agrees.
You believe what you believe. So like, even if you're following people on Twitter who are like people you agree with, yours might not necessarily point out their fake news within your own circle.
She's 19 and a sophomore at the University of Pittsburgh, where she has a subscription to the New York Times. She also gets her news from Twitter, where she follows political activists, celebrities, and others who are in line with her progressive views. Democrat Linda Bishop is 68 and a big fan of MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. But after retiring from international banking, the Mars resident spends hours a day following sources like NPR, The Washington Post, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And she's worried about how the siloed media landscape has created different versions of reality.
You know, I'm old enough to have lived through, you know, like three impeachments now. And, you know, when I look back on the Nixon and the news coverage and so on, there wasn't a Fox News, you know, and there wasn't an MSNBC, and there was just the news.
Linda doesn't have a solution, but she does think everyone needs to be skeptical of disinformation.
We have to question the things that we read, that we hear, that we see. we have to do that in order to be good citizens.
Republican Mary Henze, who's on disability and also has plenty of time to keep up with current events, has been trying to do her part ever since finding out about One America News.
I went back to my Facebook and deleted all of those sources because I did not want to be misled.
Democrat Savannah Henry agrees that disinformation is a problem, but she says it's unfair to expect busy students like her or people working multiple jobs to thoroughly vet every story they read.
To like kind of put the responsibility on me to like seek out every source I read and make sure that my information is from a 100% certified source, and I don't know, it's just I feel like it's a lot on the person.
Especially when there are so many sources out there. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Wolf administration proudly announced this month a 3% year-over-year reduction in energy use in state government buildings. How did they do it? And what's the prognosis for the much loftier goal of 26% by 2025? Mark Hand is the director of the Interagency Green Gov Council, which was created by that same gubernatorial executive order that set a goal to sharply decrease carbon pollution in the Commonwealth. Mark Hand, welcome to the Confluence.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kevin.
Mark, briefly, what actions were taken to use 3% less electricity, natural gas, and steam in state facilities?
Yeah, so the Commonwealth is using one of the major contributors to the 3% reduction is our Guaranteed Energy Savings Act program. And under Governor Wolf, we retooled and reinstituted this program. The Guaranteed Energy Savings Act program we call GESA, and it's a program where you use your utility savings from energy and water savings that you can see on in facilities, and you basically invest in new equipment in those facilities. And the idea is that you're not increasing your utility costs at those facilities. You're using the utility savings to invest in more projects. So our GESA program is the main contributor to that 3% reduction.
Right. So how did you measure it, though?
Yeah, so Pennsylvania, in 2018, we started a project with the Commonwealth Utility Benchmarking Initiative. And the Commonwealth has, as you can imagine, a number of energy meters and utility meters that we pay across the state. We have over 8,000 Commonwealth-paid utility meters in electricity and natural gas. And so in 2018, we started a process where we're benchmarking all of our utilities in one portfolio so that we can see the energy and the cost savings opportunities and reductions from our facilities. So we were able to start to pull that information together. And, you know, out of the 8,000 plus meters that we have, we were able to validate a number of those meters, most of them, and use the software Energy Cap program, which is our benchmarking program, to determine this 3% reduction.
Right. Just to confirm, those goals are only in regard to state government use and emissions. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the executive order sets out a climate goal for Pennsylvania, and the climate goal is for all of Pennsylvania. But the leadership by example goals that are in the executive order are just for Commonwealth agencies.
So that 26% is just for Commonwealth agencies?
That's correct.
Okay. Seems like 3% might be rather easily achieved. You know, adjust thermostats, turning off lights when not in use, take the steps instead of the elevator. Is each round of additional energy reductions going to be more challenging?
I think that there's a lot of opportunity in the Commonwealth with our GESA program and energy savings opportunities in general, capital investments and different processes in place. Again, we have lots of facilities, so there's lots of energy opportunities. Over time, yes. At some point in the future, it will get harder because you start to take the energy savings that was the easier to achieve. But I think we're probably several years away from that.
Mm-hmm. Some of these buildings are pretty old. How much can you actually update them to make them more efficient as opposed to replacing them?
Well, it depends. I'm sure that you can probably squeeze, 20 to 25% energy savings out of many buildings. I mean, that's just very rough approximation. So there's lots of opportunities. There's other buildings that, they may need way more investment, and it may be more beneficial to decommission those buildings and move to a different building or rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different factors that play into reinvesting in equipment like boilers and HVAC versus sort of a major reinvestment in the facility in general.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left. So are there any long-range plans for future energy-focused renovations or replacements?
We have a number of more GISA projects in the pipeline. We have 13 projects that were either completed or under solicitation or contract awards. So that's for energy efficiency improvements. And we also have the Commonwealth's doing a number of high performance buildings in new construction and major renovation. And we have 12 buildings that are in the category of high performance buildings that are incorporating a 10% reduction over essentially 2018 building codes.
Right. Mark, in our last minute, how much of a difference will it make, though, if the private sector, which uses much more energy, is not included?
Yeah, the state government is just one aspect. And so the executive order is, of course, the executive order deals with the Commonwealth facilities. And so it would certainly be helpful to get more participation from private sectors. And I think that's one of our goals as the Green Gov Council is to take the tools that we develop and the leadership by example tools that we develop in the Commonwealth and help to transfer that information to the public sector and work in a public-private way that we can hopefully influence the private sector as well. But those are sort of longer range goals, and anything we can do to encourage the private sector to participate with the executive order is certainly something that we're looking to do.
Mark Hand is the director of the Green Gov Council. That's an interagency group overseeing goals to reduce state government's carbon emissions by 26% by 2025. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Author Carmen Maria Machado's new book, In the Dream House, is a memoir about an abusive relationship and the self-censorship of queer partner violence. WESA's Katie Blackley spoke with Machado ahead of her Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures appearance.
I wanted to start by asking you about this notion of the dream house, because as we go on this journey with you, the words dream house can be, they're warm and ambitious. It's a dream. It's a dream house, but it's also kind of foggy and isolating toward the end when you feel kind of alone. How did you come up with the idea of dream house?
Oh, that's such a good question. And it's funny because actually it wasn't even initially how I sort of conceived of the book. The title for a long time was House in Indiana, which was like the title that I sold it as because it was just what I was calling it. And I kept getting questions at events for my other book where everyone's like, House in Indiana, are you from Indiana? Like, talk to us about Indiana. And I was just like, I have no thoughts about Indiana. Like, please stop asking me about the state of Indiana. And so I decided to change the title. And, I sort of was putting it off. And my editor was like, your UK and Canadian publishers really want to announce this book. So you really should like get a real title, figure out what you want to do. And so, I sat down one afternoon and I was just running through like every single sort of house idiom that I could think of and like playing with them and turning them around and breaking them apart and like trying to figure out what to do. And when Dreamhouse like sort of drew me in, and I was thinking a lot about, the language of dreams and like what it means to be like, oh, this is my dream house. And also the way in which dreams are sort of, a liminal space, a threshold, like a place where you are, your body is one place, but your mind is another. And then after I sort of settled on the title in the Dream House, the language of dreaming kept kind of popping up in all of my research, like just sort of coincidentally, which was very interesting. So I kind of kept running into it sort of over and over.
Yeah, and I think it's something people can really resonate with too.
Totally, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
The abusive relationship that you describe throughout the book, you sometimes compare it to like drinking poison, but in the way that you get you gain a tolerance for it, even though you know it's bad for you. I think this is a sentiment like held by a lot of people who have been victims of domestic abuse, that these things happen so incrementally. Did you recognize this while you were in the relationship, or did writing this memoir kind of clarify that for you?
On some level, I think I knew it was bad even in the very beginning, or I knew, like, you know, things were getting bad, but I was also pushing that away. I was sort of pushing that down. But I think the language, like calling it abuse or thinking about it as abuse, like didn't really happen until after the relationship was over. And I began to sort of talk to other people about my experience. And I was, you know, I would talk about it and people would say, I mean, that just sounds like an abusive, not just, but it sounds like an abusive relationship of what you're describing. And suddenly I realized that not only did I have language, that like the language for it had kind of always, that it existed. Like what had happened to me was actually quite a common experience that sort of hit a lot of very sort of explicable and sort of prearranged notes, which was sort of a weird thing to realize.
You talk about this too. There's a feeling of embarrassment and kind of wanting to keep conflict between queer people quiet and kind of subdued. This particularly resonated with me when I was reading this, because I feel like a lot of LGBTQ folks deal with things like domestic abuse, but they never want to talk about it. Why do you think this fear is so real for the community?
Well, because I think, you know, when you exist in a marginalized space, when you exist, you know, where your humanity is constantly being questioned, your rights are always sort of under attack, you know, your normality is sort of suspect at every turn, your humanity. There's a real pressure to sort of normalize and to create, like, you know, perform a kind of respectability politics where it's like, we're not only are we like great, or not only are we normal, but we are great. We are perfect. Like as a community, like we're better than other people at this thing. And I think it doesn't just apply to queer folks. It applies to all kinds of marginalized people. But then the problem is that then when people are like, oh, actually we're just human beings and we do human being things, and some of those things are really messed up, then you kind of have to like, and then there's like nowhere to take that story, because people are like, look, you can't you know, give us a bad reputation,
right?
Like that's really unthinkable. So it actually is like a very, it's difficult in that way.
Yeah, and I feel like it's like a disservice if you don't talk about these things.
I agree, but people don't always feel that way, you know, and people have historically, I think, felt very complicated about, you know, airing dirty laundry in communities that are sort of experiencing any kind of, that like don't have the sort of rights that they deserve.
And I want to talk a little bit about the genres that you bounce between: fairy tales, choose your own adventure, mythology, a whole mix of genres. And the blending of them all, at least for me, brought a complexity to the story that you're telling in a way that I don't know a traditional narrative could. What drew you to writing in all these different ways?
I'm just really interested in genre. Genre is just a way in which a mode of interrogation for me. And I'm just really interested in sort of what it offers us as a way of looking at our stories, looking at the way that we tell stories, looking at the ways in which things sort of unfold. It's just a useful mode of interrogation. I don't know. I find it very useful and very interesting. And so it's natural to me. It makes sense to me that this became like the way in which I began to like unpack this thing that otherwise was very much, very much eluding me.
It's what's going on in your own head.
Yeah, exactly.
At one point, you talk about wanting to invite young queers over for tea and cheese platters and advice. And I know you've been speaking around the country. Have you encountered those young queers?
Yeah, I really have. And I really like them. And I want them to be, I want them to understand the lessons that I've learned. I don't know.
Do you feel like they're more open with kind of talking about their own experiences that may not be that, you know, flawless reputation that some people want the community to have, or are they still kind of grappling with this as well?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I think some of them get it. Some of them maybe, I don't know. I guess it's hard. I don't really want to speak for them because I feel like I'm not, like, I mean, I'm young, but I'm not a young person. You know, it's like they're just coming from a really different place than me. And I don't know. But a lot of them have approached me and just said, like, thank you for writing this. Like, it meant a lot to me. Mm. And I hope that, like, maybe in my own way, I get to, like, shape a little bit of that conversation for them as they kind of come of age and go through relationships and things like that. And I find that encouraging.
Well, what would you say to someone who's going through this kind of experience maybe right now, or is, you know, looking to get out of it, or just having the same experience? How do you start to reclaim yourself?
Oh, God. I mean, it's sort of hard to be prescriptive. I think everybody's different. I mean, I find it useful to surround yourself with people that love you. I find therapy very useful. I have found that extracting yourself from a situation, like extracting yourself from a person who is harming you, I feel like there's this idea that if you leave somebody who has caused you harm, that you still owe them like a kind of friendship or, you know, like I remember when I broke up with my ex and I said I didn't want to talk to her ever again. She said I was a child. She accused me of being a child. And I was like, no, I don't want you to be in my life. And it's okay to say, like, I do not want you in my life, you know, and my life is better without you in it.
It's self-preservation.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like that's like the general advice I would give, but obviously every situation is different.
That's WESA's Katie Blackley speaking with author Carmen Maria Machado. The book is In the Dream House. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, according to the state health department, nearly half of rural hospitals in Pennsylvania are in danger of closing. The state is now expanding a program to stabilize those hospitals so they can continue to provide services in areas with more sparse populations. What more can be done? Tomorrow, a conversation about potential solutions. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistants from Caldwell Holden, Caroline Burke, and Rosa Williamson-Ray. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.